This week on Myths and Legends, it's a story from English folklore about moving day. We'll see that, if you only have the same three guys move your entire house over and over again, and you don't pay them at all, that might be a problem. Also, we'll see what to do if your parents give you a box full of men. The creature this time is a Shetland pony who will drown you, but only as a joke. This is Myths and Legends, episode 364, of mice and men, and frogs and birds. This is a podcast where we tell stories from mythology and folklore. Some are incredibly popular stories you might think you know, but with surprising origins, and others are tales that might be new to you, but are definitely worth a listen. Today, it's a story from England, about striking out on your own and getting a little help from your friends. Your tiny friends who live in your pocket. He was not a child any longer, and someday, Jack's mother and father were going to have to see it too. A towering 5'8", with hair coarse like hay on his pillow and toes sprouting from the blankets, Jack had long outgrown everything this quiet farm could offer. Because of that, he had spread his wings last year at 18 with plans to leave and flourish elsewhere. Anywhere. Just not here. He made it as far as the final fence post on the hill, in the rain with a shovel slung across one shoulder, only to return like a fly, resolved to the web. With a heavy head and heavier arms, he had trudged home, having never left. Still a boy. Perhaps now, never, to be a man. Still, also, the family's lone offspring, with no siblings to hide behind. To clap was to high-five. To peer in the mirror was to both see and set the bar for all expectations, by and for himself, aside from the demands imposed by mother and father. Pressure built beneath their watchful eyes. Oh, how Jack's parents scrutinized his every move. They pinned him beneath their feet as though he were a child, all the while demanding that he grow up, that he take some initiative, that he wake up before noon. Worst of all, that he take over the farm one day. Beneath the shell of his covers, Jack rolled, muttering while his mother's muffled boom shook the door. "Jack, come on, up and at him." Then, 10 minutes later, when no progress had been made, "I won't ask again, Jack." "Oh, too late. Here comes your father." With a clang, the door swung wide. There stood his mother sinking against the frame, wagging a finger while his father barreled past to tear the blankets away. Sheets landed in a pile as wrinkled as everyone's brows. "Breakfast in 5. Do not keep us waiting, son." His father strode away. But even as the storm passed, all Jack could think about were the hairs prickling his forehead, the ends dragging like forked tines against his lids, like tiny rakes in a garden, like the scratchy ends of bales and bales of straw. Straw, just like this one, the last one, because it was the last straw. Before he left his room, the decision was final. Today, after breakfast, Jack would leave. He would grow up, as his parents so dearly wanted, and he would start a life of his own. It was time to go. Well, after cake, of course. Then it would be time to go. After Jack's mother plunged into a cloud of baking, as was her way to manage stress, and Jack's father disappeared into the barn, which was his. Big cake or small? "Got pockets? Good. Put this in there." Jack's parents, having finished processing the news at the same time, had reconvened in unison. Four arms and four grabby hands pressed in, bearing a pair of cakes and a tiny box. "A family heirloom, a snuff box," Jack heard his father say. Mother would have her answer first, though. "Big cake or small? Small one comes with a blessing, big one brings a curse." Her eyes narrowed. "Choose your pastry wisely." Choosing, of course, implied a choice between options, and Jack could see that there was only one way to go. Long journey, more food, big cake. It came down to simple math, or, because this is an English story, maths. No, his mother sighed with a sigh. You're obviously not ready for the real world. She whirled on Jack's father. He's not ready. He's not thinking. Why would he take the big cake if it's cursed? Why would you curse a cake at all? What'd you say? I said, boy's got to make his own decisions. And I have. Jack shimmied between his parents, hoisting the big cake above his head. I will be fine, he promised. It's time for me to go seek my fortune. So I'm going to go now. I'm leaving. For real this time. Goodbye. All that had taken place just an hour ago, maybe two. Jack had thanked his parents for a wonderful start at life, sprinkled hugs around, and started up the hill along the line of fence posts. At the last one, he gulped, and with his next step, crossed the threshold, hero's journey, into a new beginning, and the real meat of the story now that the foundation had been laid. Never mind that his mother's voice full of directives still carried on the wind, because she was still down there shouting. Never mind his father's disturbing message as his son left for good. The snuff box is to be opened only if your life is in grave danger. Only then, son. Notice how gravelly and intense my voice is getting. For generations, we've never needed it, but I feel you might. It had felt ominous at the moment, and now even more so. Jack shivered. Passing thoughts, he decided. That was where these feelings came from, not from any real danger in the world. It was all inside him. Just like the cursed big cake neither of his parents wanted credit for in the end. Don't eat it all at once, they'd chimed like a clock. On that alone, mother and father had been able to agree. But all Jack heard was, eat it all at once. So he did. First thing after crossing the threshold. And now, the only prize left was the family heirloom. The snuff box he'd not known about until today, and had to look up online because he wasn't sure exactly what that was. I mean, he had an idea, but it was really something he should know. Turned out it was not a matchbox, as he'd first thought, though it was a small box. It was meant to hold snuff or tobacco, which made a lot more sense. And this one, the family snuff box, was ornate and golden and still tucked snugly in a pocket. The gift had been a lovely gesture from his parents, but as the sun went down, Jack started wishing it were spare clothes or bedding or actual protein or anything to see by or warm his hands beside. So, when the faintest glow of a roof in the distance popped over the next hill, Jack took off at a sprint. He ran with a grin, breaking the roll in his cheeks because this was it. His first night alone, his adventure, it was finally beginning. Inside, the fire danced, and the blankets itched in a way that never let you forget they were there. It was perfect. Like the timing of the servant opening the back door of the massive estate to dump the dirty dishwater. A plea from a stranger in the shadows for one night's lodging had turned into a meal of scraps, a seat by the hearth, and a place to lay his head for the night. Jack, as the young man called himself, had promised to be no trouble and to be gone by first light. Only then had the kitchen emptied for the evening. Mary had heard the whole account straight from the servant even before stealing a look herself. There he was. Jack with the shivers. Jack without a home. Without a job. Wandering the countryside without anything to his name at all. Without any idea he was being watched. But in a sweet way, not a creepy way. Can we keep him? Mary asked, spinning to her father. She clutched both hands beneath her chin and ate her lips. The boy, of course, was not a puppy. And her father refused to hear another word. That's when Mary straightened. A job, father. I mean, can we offer him a job? Sleeping in a new place was difficult, and Jack surmised it might always be that his wide eyes never blinked. Not because he wasn't tired, because he was. That the tremble in his fingers was not a response to the cold. Because by the hearth, it wasn't. The servant who had welcomed him was long gone, and in the dim light of the kitchen, the pair of unclaimed voices seeping through the walls sounded all the more intimidating. The job, father, that was the best that Jack could piece together, all that he had heard echoing in his thoughts, as the door beyond view burst open. On your feet, young man, came a growl. Jack scurried to his toes, scuffed boots, then pants. Then a wide presence rolled into the glow of the embers. Atop the pile, a man's face bobbed, taut as leather, with a mouth that moved but did not smile. All the while, the growl grew louder. An offer a humble guest could not refuse. Employment, skills. Tell me, what can you do, young man? Do? Why, Jack could do anything, anything at all, he promised, which is not what you want to say, because this is what made the man break into a grin. He rolled his shoulders and started to pace. Well, if that was the case, my boy, then do this for me. By 8 a.m. tomorrow, let's see a lake dug out in front of my house, a big one. Make it 4 miles around. Oh, and let there be a fleet of ships waiting for my command. The man readied an eye with a hand and steadied the bounce of his belly with the palm of another. No, he circled back. Make that ships firing a salute of guns so loud the legs of my daughter's bed break. She's really difficult to wake up these days. At the start, Jack had bitten a finger. By the middle, he was gripping his temples, and now he was full-on ripping out his hair. That was impossible. But though the young man opened his mouth, no protest came. That was not until a loud gentleman pointed a finger. And if that task was not completed by 8 a.m., then it would be Jack's life that would be lost in the morning at exactly 8:01. But no one can do what you're asking, Jack said. Also, you're not a king. You can't, legally kill me. Right? This was, however, exactly the point. The impossible nature, the sudden demands. You see, young man, my daughter wants me to employ you, but I do not. So I did just now, to make her happy. And in the morning, she and I will both be happy, because, you see, you might think that I can't legally kill you, and you'd be right. But who really knows you're here? Jack straightened up in bed. You also might be thinking that you can run, to which I say, please, that will make it so much more enjoyable. Not until tomorrow, though. I want to be in top form to enjoy the hunt. The job father turned and shouted, take him to the turret room and be sure to lock him inside. Guards trotted into the room and seized Jack by the armpits. They dragged him away and through a hall and lugged him up a twisty flight of stairs. Near the top, he'd fallen just before another door slammed. And now only a narrow window broke the curve of stone, closing in on all sides. In the darkness, Jack's sigh fizzled long and thin. His first night alone, his adventure, wasn't this supposed to be a grand beginning? He sank against the wall. Sleeping in a new place would be even more difficult, now that his execution was scheduled for the morning. Also, hey, how am I supposed to do all the stuff that you asked if I can't get out of the cell? Jack called out, and then, oh, okay, no, he understood. Yeah. We'll see Jack immediately get executed, and we'll just sit here quietly for another half an hour, but that will be right after this. Underwear drawers are like the Wild West of wardrobes. There's no rhyme or reason to them.
It's pure chaos?
It is. In there, anything goes. You've got a mishmash of brands and fits in there. Who knows what you're going to come out with?
It's time for a change. And once we tried MeUndies, we just knew. All the other pairs have got to go.
MeUndies is what I reach for now. And I'm honestly kind of hooked. I know what I'm getting, and it's buttery soft comfort every day.
Comfort that fits me.
And also me.
All of us, actually, because not only does MeUndies have the look, from solid classics to fun expressive prints, they come in size extra small to 4XL in an array of flattering cuts for every body, which means everybody.
Personally, boxer briefs are the way to go, and with the Modal Crew tee on top, I've never had anything this soft before. That's also responsibly sourced. My newest are both in dark sapphire, and this is probably my favorite color.
I have some dark sapphire too, but I also like the bold prints. There's one that's covered in books, which is completely
totally you. MeUndies is our new favorite because we can be classic, bold, and adventurous, but with a consistent comfort and fit we love. Get 20% off your first order, plus free shipping, at MeUndies.com/legends. That's MeUndies.com/legends for 20% off, plus free shipping. MeUndies, comfort from the outside in.
If you're here, it's probably because you like a good story. Well, this is our second week getting back into a game and a story all in one. I'm talking about June's journey.
I'm really enjoying how this game is unfolding. Playing as the detective, June Parker, I'm on the search, and each new hidden object scene gives me new clues. It's chill, but I'm also on the edge of my seat, you know?
Oh, I have to know what happened to Claire and Harry. I mean, there was the photograph evidence, which made me think one way, but then there was the open gate. I'm only on chapter 4 right now, but the plot thickens.
It's this interactive, investigative, narrative aspect to June's journey that I think Myths and Legends listeners will especially love. I know I do. With this game, you're finding hidden clues to uncover a murder mystery that takes place in the roaring 20s. You have to be observant, and the way it's designed, you really feel like you're part of the tale.
This game is my current favorite, especially after dinner when we're just all taking a moment to relax. The homework's done, dishes are done, it's not quite bedtime yet. In that moment with June's journey, I'm not on the couch. In my head, I'm on Orchid Island solving a mystery.
I'm gonna do it too. I will figure it out. And you know what? June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Sleeping was difficult, but not inevitable. And that was what the young man discovered as he woke with a start. The door to his cell remained locked. And at the window, Jack caught a whiff of the breeze. His last. He stretched and held the sides of his neck, well, warm and intact. That's a plus. But also, probably the last time he would do that. He slumped anew. And this time his elbow knocked against the rattle in his pocket. Wait, the box. The golden snuff box. His family's heirloom passed and passed, and soon to be lost. At this link in the chain. The box to be opened if his life was ever in danger. Well, that seemed to be the case now. Jack's nail bent backwards and prying the thing open, but it was the commotion that made him gasp, not from the door, which had not moved, but from the snuffbox in his hand. From the figures sitting up inside the snuffbox, wearing tapered nightcaps and rubbing their eyes, as Jack had often done at home. There were three of them, squished like sardines. A trio of tiny people, smaller than green beans, with moving arms and legs, and dressed head to toe in red. "We prefer scarlet," said one of them. "It went with their gray hair," another chimed in, "which is in the story, and not just because Carissa and I both went to Ohio State." All three of them hopped over the rim onto Jack's leg, and then the floor, rolling up their sleeves as they landed. "Well, what can we do for you, Captain? Why have you woken us after all these years?" This was unbelievable. Jack decided to go for it, though. He told them about his depressing little pickle he was in. The lakes, the ships, the morning salute, the probably being hunted. "Say no more," interrupted the little figure in the middle, and they were off. All three snuffbox dwellers in their snug scarlet outfits, and incredible leaps and bounds. They had hardly been gone when a voice on the other side of the cell door announced the arrival of the 8 o'clock hour. Sinister laughter followed, and no doubt a considerable amount of mustache twirling, followed by, "That Jack's a dead man." Or at least that's what Jack would have heard, had the blast of cannon after cannon not exploded beyond the window, on hands and knees. Even with his limited view, Jack noted smoke billowing in dark clouds outside, encircled by the brightest sheen, as though the morning sun reflected off a lake. A lake! It was there, just outside the gentleman's house where nothing but lawns and trees had stood the day before. So too, there they were again. Three little figures bounding over the hill, sprinting back into the snuffbox with feet like springs, their arms motioning for Jack to replace the lid. "Okay, I need, like, a lot more context. Are you guys, obviously you're magic, but, like, what in the world? What do you eat? How do you go to the bathroom? Like, so many questions." "Give us more lead time in the future," grumbled one of them, massaging his shoulder. The other two apologized for their friend, banished him to the back of the snuffbox, and bid Jack good night. It was a little unbelievable. The little box, the enormous lake, it was all Jack could think about. And it was the only word the scary gentleman of the house could say as he waltzed into the cell, shortly after, with robes flapping like his jowls. Behind him, the young man caught something else. Someone else. The daughter, by the servant's address. She was peeking into the room. Here, someone his age, someone Jack was obviously going to marry, because wasn't that how this worked? How all these stories unfolded? Obviously, the young lady agreed, as though she'd read his thoughts. She stepped into the room and shared that her name was Mary. She held out her hand, and Jack knelt to kiss it. Mary's father, however, came around like a wayward sail. No, no, no. He made a show of recognizing exactly what was going on there. There would be no hasty marriage, no love at first sight, no trusting of this Jack fellow who, yes, had pulled off a miracle. By the way, the lake was breathtaking, the view even more stunning than imagined. It made him feel wonderful, beautiful feelings. But could the boy do it again? That was the question that brought the finger tap on Jack's sternum like a hammer. Was this miracle a fluke? Was it simply a trick? That ship seemed real. The dad had a servant drink the lake water, and it gave him a stunning amount of diarrhea, which tracks for the water at this time. But how did they know this wasn't just a fluke? It's because Jack would have to do it again. Jack stifled a cough at the puff of morning breath clouding his face. In his position, there was nothing else he could do but not. My daughter needs a grand house, the loud man cut in. So you will build her one, a lake house. But not a house on the lake. Make it on the lake, literally in the middle of the water, lofted on no less than 12 golden pillars. Jack had no choice but to agree, because yet again, the cost of failure was to be his life. 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, Jack. The house, on the lake, and at a church if you're so bent on getting married, or else it's your head. Now let's go have a party. It was all so very confusing, this pendulum dynamic. And if people oscillate wildly between trying to have you murdered and partying with you, it's not a healthy relationship. Jack understood being stressed, but when that led to someone lashing out and, well, murdering people, that made you part of the problem. This was super weird, too, because Jack had access to all the features of being part of the family, but this was still a trial period. He had Mary's green light, but not the green light to marry Mary, even though Mary and Mary made him marry, and Mary quite agreed. I mean, it was so confusing, whatever this was. But it was actually kind of fun, too, and he blended in and deferred the work of moving a whole house until later. He waved on cue, he smiled on cue, he ate and drank and cheered with the masses, and then when the sun began to set, he fell in line behind the others as they trickled back into the house. Only he wasn't one of them. Not truly. Everyone else turned and left while the guards steered him right, through a side door, down a hall, up the twisty stairs to the turret tower prison cell from the night before. Miracle, execution, reality came flooding back in as the air cooled and the sliver of moonlight crept past Jack's legs. Well, the silver lining of having his life in danger again was that the snuffbox could be called upon a second time to work its magic. Fortunately as well, Jack would be able to give the helpers inside the magic box more lead time, just like the tiny figures in Scarlet had wanted, and he's just going to shut his eyes for like a minute. Just don't worry about it. He'll be fine. Jack, having never experienced wine before the previous day, loved it when he was out partying and hated it when he woke up with a pounding head, completely dehydrated the following morning. Wait, morning? Jack's hand flew to his pocket, to the depths that produced nothing but lint and seams. And then to the other side, only to find the same. He didn't have the snuffbox. Then he remembered he worried about misplacing it and had put it under his pillow, not really considering that they could have locked him up in a different room. Help me, he gasped, tearing off the lid. There wasn't much time before the 8 o'clock hour. In fact, there was even less time than last time, and Jack was very apologetic that that was the case. This he shared especially to the little figure in the middle of the box, the one with the permanent scowl. The other two pushed and pulled their friend, and with a grumble, the Scarlet trio dashed for the window, falling over one another in their hustle to move house and home. Not a minute later, they returned and turned into the snuffbox. Just before the door to the cell flew open, the hour had come, the loud man of the house announced. That bright 8 o'clock hour in which Jack would prove that he was no good and that he had failed to... Oh, that's so nice. Well, I'll be, the man murmured. You did it. He squinted with his face pressed against the edges of the window. I don't know how you did it, but you did it. Does this mean I can marry Mary? Because No, stop it. No one wants to hear that again. The dad snapped at Jack's slightly overdone wordplay. A third voice joined the room. It was Mary with a smile bigger than the sun. I don't know, Jack, she said, but I do know that I want to marry him. It was for his wordplay, first and foremost, of course. Ladies love an English major. And also for the plot of the story, and largely because he had done the impossible, not once, but twice. So the dad, not wanting to go full medieval dad and end up dead himself, through a violent mishap brought about by his own intransigence, agreed. It was settled. The wedding would happen that very day. All that had taken place a good 2 weeks ago, and by now, Jack was starting to feel at home. In his new home, with his wife, it felt weird to say, but he was getting used to it. To celebrate, the family and many of its staffers, whose names had been drawn from a hat, had decided to take a hunting trip. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Stop right there, big guy. You can't wear that out there. Jack lurched in his tracks. But he'd just gone and changed out of his waistcoat and into his hunting coat. Wasn't that what his new father-in-law just told him to do? Also, why were there so many coats in British formal wear? It was, and there were. Except that he put on the green hunting coat when he was supposed to put on the scarlet hunting coat today. Once again, not a shout out to OSU. So go change or else we're never going to get on the road. Soon, but later than planned, Jack, Mary, her loud father, and everyone else selected for the day gathered on the deck, reconvened on land, and took off on gleaming horses. It was perfection. The sun was shining. The adventure was continuing. Jack could not have been more pleased. The servant could not have been more disappointed. The invite had been hers, officially. But then at the final moment, Mary's father blustered in with the bad news. The group was too big. Some of the names in the hat had stuck together. It was a whole thing involving jam and a joke that didn't land. But on the long and short of it was, oh, she couldn't go hunting. Those were the words that came out of his mouth. Even though the servant was why Jack had come into their home at all, she was the one at the back door that day. Even though she had been the one to suggest hunting in the first place, every variation of, I'm sorry, had been offered. But in the end, they were gone, and she was not. She could not have been more disappointed. In the stillness of the house on the lake, the few homebound staffers took to cleaning and chores. That's how the disappointed servant ended up in Jack's quarters all alone, folding a green hunting cloak crumpled by the door, shaking out a waistcoat thrown over a chair. Something tumbled onto the floor with a rattle. It glistened by the light of the sun through the window, sparkling beside the crease on her shoe. It felt fragile between her fingers and clattered as it fell back to the floor. She'd not meant to pry and master Jack's things, but the lid had fallen off, and when tiny creatures in red jumpsuits started climbing her arm, she had recoiled. She'd stifled a scream and shook them off. Who were they? What were they? First, said the one in the middle, it's Scarlet, and they're not jumpsuits. The other two on each side of the speaker stepped in front. You'll have to excuse him. He hasn't been sleeping well. What can we do for you, Captain? Captain, do for you. All the servant could do was stare as the little figures rolled their eyes. Your life is in danger? Why else would you summon us? So how can we help? And keep in mind that we can't tell the difference between any human, so. All three figures had trudged back into the little box on the floor, and at this, the one in the middle threw up his arms. Told you this was going to happen. Woken up when they weren't even needed, he glared at his partners. We ought to take this whole house back, golden pillars and all. The others pounced with hands clamped over their friend's mouth, while the servant set down the waistcoat in her arms. She knelt close to the snuff box with a smile that didn't look like one. Tell me more, she said. The lid of the box was already in her hands. Navigation was not Jack's strong suit, but even he was sure that this was where the house had been when they left to go hunting. The house lofted above the waters, propped on pillars of gold. All of it was gone. There was only his father-in-law's finger pounding his sternum again. You're a cheat, and you're a dead cheat. Do you hear me? Dead. 12 months, Jack croaked. He begged Mary, her father, all the staffers. He begged them all for 12 months. I'd better make it 12 months in a day to find the house and bring it back. Please, 1 year and one day. That's all he needed. The thing was, Jack had realized on the hunting trip that he'd left the golden snuff box behind in his other coat. He was disappointed then and near distraught now. And what he didn't tell the others as he rode away was that he didn't care about the house or the pillars. It was all about the snuff box, the missing snuff box, and the little creatures inside, the ones that he'd come to depend on for everything. C see how surprisingly easy it is to misplace a house, but that will, once again, be right after this. Jack had been everywhere and asked everyone, but there was no sign of a house or pillars or shiny box the size of his palm. The sun was beginning to set over the field, where he lay with an arm draped across his eyes. His horse stood off to the side, stomping and chomping. All his hope had run dry. "Hey, at least you have 8 months left to search, squeak squeak," offered a, yes, squeaky voice. And Jack nodded. That was true. He sat up. To his left, the horse swished a tail. To his right, hills rose in the distance, next to a line of trees. All around, there was nothing but grass. Nothing save a little mouse in a dazzling hauberk, with a matching cap and a spear the size of a toothpick. "Sentry," the mouse explained. That was how Jack ended up here, in the court of the King of the Mice. Or rather, according to the story, King of all the mice in the wide world. It's annoying and official, like how Ohio State insists on going by the Ohio State University, which I'm realizing is now the third Ohio State reference I've made in one episode. In short order, the kind king had sent a call for all of his mousy subjects, seeking information about a missing castle. And what was it again? Oh, a snuff box? Had anyone seen the snuff box roughly the size of a wedge of cheese? Noses pulsed and whiskers danced. Then as one, they all said no, they had not seen either of the items in question. "If it's anywhere to be found on land, my mice will know," the King of the Mice assured, in a surprisingly commanding baritone. "So, your only option now is to speak with my elder brother." That was how Jack ended up here, kneeling before the King of all the Frogs. He was just King of all the Frogs, they were chill like that. They were brothers, was all Jack could think. The King of the Mouse and the King of the Frogs. It was like an in-law situation, or... Jack felt a pinch at the side of his ankle and shut his mouth. Next to his feet, a lone mouse stood tall and scowled. They had talked about this on the ride over. As the mouse sat in Jack's hair, not controlling his movements, Sentry had become friend on the short journey together. But now Jack was bringing up the one thing he was told not to mention, the thing that not even the original story chooses to address at all. "Crow, crow, crow," the King of the Frogs croaked, because that's the sound frogs make, from the throne. The frogs had not been keen on the arrival of a human in their lands, and it was only because the frog sentries recognized the mouse sentry from the last year's holiday gift exchange that Jack had been allowed to enter at all. "Crow," came the answer again, which everyone knew meant no. It's a more context tonal language, I guess. None of the frogs had seen or heard of a disappearing castle or a castle on the run or a snuffbox, whatever that was. I think it was about the size of 40 flies. But there was still one option left, one who might know something. The King of the Mice and the King of the Frogs' eldest brother, whom neither had seen for some time. The King of the Birds. This was, of course, how Jack ended up in front and center at BirdCon, formerly known as the Grand Assembly, surrounded by wrens, doves, cormorants, and many more he could not name. The mouse sentry had stuck by his side, literally in one pocket, joined by one of the frog sentries, who'd opted to come along in the other. It was a good thing the frog was there too, seeing as how the sparrow and crow sentries did not recognize the mouse sentry. Also, Jack and company did not have tickets to BirdCon or the Grand Assembly. And this ended up being the biggest problem, but no matter. The frog convinced the sparrow and crow to let them in. And now Jack was here hoping for his missing house, which everyone assumed was a castle, in the snuffbox. "Well, Your Majesty, do you think you might be able to help me?" "Eagle." That was all the King of the Birds would say, again and again, each time louder and gruffer, looking everywhere but at Jack. "Eagle." The Bird King fumed. And by his words, everyone seemed to know what he meant. It was, "Where is Eagle? Why is Eagle not here?" Their language wasn't as repetitive as the frogs. Only a tomtit from the wings ventured a reply, seeing as he was the Chamberlain, and it was his duty. Eagle was late, and that was all there was to it. "Well, summon him again," the king squawked. He turned, then, to Jack. "We will wait and see what Eagle has to say about your missing castle." After 20 minutes, Eagle arrived. He landed in a ball of feathers and beak, ruffled and weathered, and sweaty? So sweaty, yes, The story makes a point to mention eagles' perspiration from having flown so fast. Which, before you Google it, no, eagles do not have sweat glands. News and apologies spewed with little coherency into a finale of jubilation. Eagle had seen the castle, the one perched on pillars of gold. That was what had taken so long. The cheer was enough to shake the king's throne. "Take the boy to his castle, then," commanded Bird King above the celebration, half of which chirped for the finding of the castle, half of which chirped to getting back to BirdCon already. And so, with all haste, Eagle toweled off, downed, yes, a whole cow to replenish his strength, and soared with Jack and his friends toward the setting sun. It was Eagle who knew the way, and on his back, Jack, who had found hope once again, and Frog, sleeping in Jack's pocket. And on the other, the mouse sentry in his adorable hauberk and cap, ready to see this adventure through. Traveling all Bilbo style, Jack nodded off as they coasted above land and water. Just as the new sun cracked the horizon, there it was, the house and its pillars, calling like the end of the rainbow. The only problem was that the front door was boarded shut. So too, all the windows, the back entrance, and everything. Jack could not sneak inside to retrieve his precious snuffbox, no matter how hard he tried. How was he supposed to know that the servant who stole the place was out hunting? At last, like she'd been promised. That she went out hunting every day now, just because she could. And that to protect the house and the magical snuffbox from thieves exactly like Jack, you know, the incredibly common thieves with mouse and frog friends riding on the backs of eagles, she locked and boarded the home every time she left. One look, and the mouse sentry scurried into view. This was a job for him, obviously, being a mouse who finished what he started. A mouse not distracted by cookies and napping and milk. He was nearly spitting by the end, obviously still perturbed by the mouse and cookie heckles tossed his way back at BirdCon. He had been stewing about it in Jack's pocket the entire flight. "You want to talk about it?" "Yeah, we're here if you want to get it out." The mouse shook his head. "Thanks, I appreciate that. But right now, I'm just going to focus on the job, you know? There's a hole in every castle," he said, shaking it off. "Just give me a moment to find it." And he returned shortly, wobbling on hind legs with a shiny snuffbox in his arms. Success. For the mouse, but also for Jack, with that goofy smile on his face. With the snuffbox in his pocket once more, the house could be returned to Mary and her father before the year's end. Jack was safe. "Take it back." "I won't." "You will. There's nothing to take back." "Say, give a mouse a cookie one more time." "But you're eating a cookie. You're a mouse eating a cookie." It was the shouting, mostly, but also the shoving and the turbulence aboard Eagle Flight 1 that tore Jack from his slumber. He had not realized how stressed he'd been about the house and the snuffbox until imminent death was no longer on his plate. Sleep had come easy after that. But for Frog and Mouse, things had come to a head. In fact, they were on their way to a duel. "Guys," Jack sputtered. Both sentries paused. Jack had meant to help them work it out, but when his hand fell to his leg and found his pockets flat and missing the all-important snuffbox, the one that they'd come all the way out here to retrieve, he found himself singing a different tune. "Hey, did you take my snuffbox from my pocket while I was sleeping?" Jack turned, looking at Mouse, who, yes, was waving the snuffbox above his head, proving that he was worth more than Frog because he actually did something on this mission other than say crow like 70 times. Mouse couldn't know that Frog decided to lunge at that very moment. And since neither were wearing a seatbelt or sitting in their seats at all, Mouse and Frog rolled like socks in a dryer. And the snuffbox, well, the snuffbox spun and soared and then tumbled and plummeted, landing with a splash in the sea below. For a moment, Mouse and Frog stared at one another, their rage suddenly gone. They looked at the clouds, stealing side glances at Jack, whose smile had faded. "Guess it doesn't float," said Mouse. "Yeah, I guess it's my turn to go get it," said Frog. "Doing something on this mission, hmm?" And he was right. His dive was perfection and sent rings spreading across the surface of the water. After a long while, the round of his nose appeared. "How'd it go?" Jack cried, leaning in over the side of the eagle as far as he dared. They had been circling for nearly 10 minutes. Frog shook his head. He didn't have it. We'll get back to it. Mouse crossed his arms and sat down. Well, I will, came a faint reply. Frog caught his breath, splished, and when he splashed again, 2 days and two nights had passed. But on his head sat the shiniest box, the prize. Frog had come through, and just in time to catch the final day of BirdCon. Eagle was happy, but the king of the birds was not. Subjects had flown in from far and wide for Eagle's keynote address, which had to be canceled. And to make up for it, the king had promised everyone a fly-through with a mysterious castle on golden pillars. Which I don't see, Bird King spat. Which he doesn't see, echoed the Tomtit Chamberlain. Jack had ruffled more than a few feathers. When he was declared a cheat and a liar on the spot, or would be, rather, unless he could produce his lost and found castle by 8 o'clock in the morning. Needless to say, that night Jack pulled the golden snuffbox from his pocket and roused the little magic figures in scarlet. The one in the middle had grown a beard in his time away and shot up spouting about using the box only when one's life was in danger and abusing privileges and, oh, it's you again, he said at the end. What do you want? He leaned an ear as a hand pulled on his shoulder. Oh, right. Captain. What does Captain want? It was easy enough in the end, and the site was, it was a hit. Some might say it even elevated BirdCon that year, to the point that the King of the Birds gave Jack his blessing to leave with his reputation intact. Not that Jack cared, anyway, they're just a bunch of birds. On horseback, Jack rode once he'd come, with Frog and Mouse in his pockets. And wouldn't you know it, the same thing happened with the King of the Frogs, minus the convention, of course. FrogCon was deeply in debt, and probably would not take place this year. And with the king of all the mice in the wide world, too. Such that the little figures inside the snuffbox were getting really annoyed with the whole story. When were they supposed to sleep? When were they supposed to ice their backs and schedule a decent haircut with all this open, closed, moving a house across the world business? Jack's life was not in danger. This was literally the one rule to using the snuffbox. But my life is in danger, Jack insisted. This time, it was. They were back to the lake where Mary and her father and all the servants had set up makeshift tents while they waited for their house to come home. And since so much time had passed, if the house on Golden Pillars was not returned to the middle of the lake by 8 a.m. the next morning, it would be Jack's life that was lost. So, you see, he explained, I really do need your help, if you wouldn't mind. And the sun is only now just setting, so you have all night to work at your leisure. Jack had run through the imaginary conversation several times in his head as he lay inside his tent. He struggled to perfect the wording, which would be necessary, seeing as how angry the snuffbox dwellers had been the last time. All the times, actually, with increasing frustration and volume and threats of violence. In the end, Jack had split the difference between disrupting their sleep early and giving them ample time to work. At 5 luxurious minutes before his literal deadline, Jack pried the lid from the box and braced for the earful that ensued. He listened with head down as the two on the outside grumbled and stomped, as the one in the middle with the temper spewed threats of all sorts of things. We probably have to put a disclaimer on here. Eventually, the other two stepped in and said, what could they do for Captain today? There was a weariness in the figure's features that made Jack feel bad, but, I mean, danger was upon him. And so he made his ask. In leaps and bounds, the snuffbox dwellers shot away, and Jack's breathing slowed. This was bad, I mean, worse than anticipated, but it would be over soon. It would be okay. And when the magic figures returned, Jack would thank them and promise not to wake them for years and years on end. He would. Or rather, he would have. Mist gathered on the water as the sun dried the dew in sharp lines on the lawn. Amid the cloud, the house on Golden Pillars stood strong and inviting, and already Mary and her father were directing servants to move back in. Are you okay? She asked, stepping between trunks. Jack looked down and rested a hand atop Mary's in the crook of his arm. It's empty, he murmured. In his free hand, a small golden box sat atop his palm, the lid beside it. That's really nice. Is that like a family heirloom or something? She asked. It was. It had been. He pressed the lid onto the bottom until it caught. It still is, he said, and slid it into a pocket. Thank you. some level, this story is about Jack's ability to live on his own, without the aid of three little men who live in the snuffbox. Realizing that he's an adult who can handle his own problems now, and he doesn't need magic. My vote? Probably treat your workers a little bit better, and you can have a little bit of both. Solve your own problems like the grown-up adult you are, but also have three magical tiny elves that can build a golden house for you. Next week, we're in Korean folklore, with goblin stories, and we learn how to get unlimited floor beef. If you'd like to support the show, there's still a membership thing on the site. For less than the price of a video AI bird feeder that can identify up to 6,000 species of birds, you can get extra episodes and ad-free versions of the show that won't just send you videos of squirrels eating all your bird seed. Check out mythpodcast.com/membership for more info on the membership. The creature this week is the Noogle from the Shetland Islands. We have a Shetland sheepdog now, which is like a collie but smaller. A Shetland pony is similar. It's like a regular horse, but smaller. The Noogle is just one step away from that. It's a Shetland pony that lives in the water, hates mill wheels, and yes, might kill you, but only by accident if that makes you feel any better, but probably doesn't because you'd be dead. Yes, just like the Kelpie, the creature that will tempt you to ride on its back. The Noogle beckons riders and then drags them into the water. In researching this creature, I actually learned that you can ride Shetland ponies. Well, I can't. I'm in the neighborhood of 200 pounds, no need to go into specifics. But I guess Shetland ponies shouldn't have a rider heavier than about 100 pounds. I found this on Google, though, and since people poisoned it with AI to get it to say you can melt eggs, who really knows anything anymore? Back to the creature. Yes, it's like a tiny Kelpie who can only lure responsible, smaller riders, and it will mess with them by pulling them underwater. Unlike any Kelpie, it was only doing it as a joke. But if you've ever been in a playful water fight that escalated way too quickly and been dunked unexpectedly, you know that there is virtually no difference between just playing around and I think I'm drowning. At least with the Noogle, you get to enjoy the blue sparkles and shimmers that shoot from the creature as it descends into the ocean with its little prank. So that's fun until it's not. You can spot the Noogle by its tail that resembles a wheel. Not sure how that works, honestly, but it does appear to use the tail for propulsion. Said to try to lure people with a tame ride as they walk along the road at night, the Noogle would keep at it. So if you see the same tiny horse multiple times, they didn't change something in the Matrix. That's just the Noogle's clumsy attempt to entrap you. Pointedly, they hate water wheels and will seek to destroy them, like water wheels the type that turn a mill. No one really knows why. If you find yourself riding a Shetland pony toward the water, remember to call in the name of God. Or call the Noogle's name. Both of these being the way to get it to release its sticky grip. They are also afraid of iron, specifically knives, which feels like they're just afraid of knives. That's it for this week. Myths and Legends is by Jason and Carissa Weiser. Our theme song is by Broke for Free, and the Creature of the Week music is by Steve Combs. There are links to even more of the music we used in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.